Halt!
He shouted, imbuing his voice with power. But the kestrel kept coming. She held no weapon, but her hands were protected by fingerless gloves. Isan pulled his god's gift, his triple-bladed dagger, from its sheath by his side. She came to a halt as he swung the blade in a broad arc, a warning for all the good it would do.
I command you to stop!
But the kestrel didn't. She stepped forward as Isan gave himself over to another violent swing, and then she was on him, snatching his wrist as quick as her namesake, while kicking one leg into the air. Then her body was up, twisting, her thighs locking around his neck. Her momentum carried her, and she used her hold around his neck to draw him forward and down, his body whipping past her so that he fell hard on the carpet. As the pain was just beginning to register, she rolled off him, twisting his hand as she went. His wrist and arm were torqued so ferociously, his knife dropped to the carpet beside him. She immediately kicked it away, just out of reach. If he were able to crawl only a tiny bit, he might reach it, but it may as well have been lying on the other side of the desert. His wrist and shoulder were in such agony, he could make no move toward it. And even if he could stifle the pain, it would be child's play for the kestrel to break his wrist or dislocate his shoulder.
Release me!
A pitiful appeal made through a veil of pain. The kestrel was indifferent to the power of his voice. She grabbed a fistful of hair, sent a knee into his lower back, and pressed him into the carpets. Zaheb had made his way around the low table. When he came near, he took one knee and turned his head to the side so that Isan could see him clearly.
She's deaf, he said. I had her hearing taken from her years ago, in case I ever needed to move against you. She won't hesitate to cut a smile across your throat should I give the sign. If you say but one word of command against me, I'll be able to resist long enough to signal her. I am a king!
Zaheb's face screwed up in disgust.
I see no king. I see a man who lives or dies at my whim.
His angry eyes bored into Isan's.
When you talked of ruling Sharakai together years ago, I doubted you. I not only came to believe you were sincere, I'm nearly certain you never once used your power on me. Am I wrong?
Isan's neck was pressed so hard, the simple act of drawing breath caused pain. Speaking was worse.
Why would I have needed it? You wanted to believe my words as much as I did. I may have been blinded years ago. But now I know the truth. Your eyes see only enemies. Even Nayan will one day wither in your regard. Please, Zaheb. I was in error. But I would still do as we've long planned.
Zaheb nodded to the kestrel, who arched Isan's head back so hard he feared his neck would break.
For once be quiet, Isan.
Zaheb leaned closer, leering.
Know that there are others like her.
Know that I can and will call upon them if the need arises.
And that there's nothing you can do to stop them once they've been given your scent. Know that they have standing orders if you command me to kill myself or I die in some mysterious manner. Lastly, know that it won't be you who's taken first, but Nayan. Nayan and the child you thought to hide from us all.
Despite all that had happened in this room, something cold slipped between Isan's ribs. Crept ever deeper toward his heart. He knew it well. The fear of losing a child, the anguish of knowing you might have helped but failed.
You will not come to me like this again. If I have need, I will summon you, Do you understand me, Isan?
In the darkness, a vision of his daughter swam before him. Farah, lying on a throne, her wrists slit. The kestrel wrenched his head back farther, eliciting a scream that echoed those he'd shed for Farah when he had entered his throne room and found her dead.
I understand, he managed,
pounding the carpet with one hand. Zaheb studied his eyes a moment longer, then made a new sign to the kestrel. She released him, then melded back into the darkness. Taking up the small lamp, Zaheb began walking toward the back of the throne room.
You can see yourself out.
Zaheb walked silently away and was gone, the light diminishing with him. Chapter 32. Davood couldn't sleep after returning from the cavern with the kings. The dreams were haunting. Visions of the kings swam before him, Kiral, Cahill, and Husamitin standing in the background, grim-faced, while Sukru demanded to know why Davood had done nothing to stop Yerinde. Every time Sukru spoke her name, the face of the goddess came to him, piercing him over and over with those violet eyes.
Her head. Bring me her head.
Bring me her head.
The words built in intensity until he woke sweating, wondering why a god would ask for the head of one of their own. Can the gods not squabble? Certainly, he reasoned, but why not take her head themselves? He recalled his vision of Gojan running after Nalame, how she had denied him, left him bleeding near the blooming fields. What can the kings do where the gods have failed? But then he remembered all of Chaedah's research below the Collegia. He'd read everything she had asked him to bring, partly to ensure it was something she'd want, but also to satisfy his own curiosity. He'd seen in those texts the number of times the gods had hunted Nalame down, only to have her reappear years later. Was this some new attempt on their part to finish the job once and for all? Sukru had been prominent in his dreams as well. He would swoop down like a vulture and thrust a knife into the center of Davood's chest. Face sweaty, eyes like a rat in the night, he snarled.
What good have you been to me, fool boy?
As dawn approached, he gave up on sleep and went for a walk around the palace. It was calming, the grounds dreamlike under Tulathan's silver light. He wandered the gravel walks, the topiary, the small ponds filled with exotic fish. He even wandered the hedge maze for a time, breathing deeply of its piney scent, which did wonders to dispel his dreams. He was heading back to his room when he saw a dark form walking through the archway that led to the boneyard. A woman, surely one of those who tended to the graves and crypts. No, it was Anila. Standing as he was, behind the statue of a spread-winged crane. She didn't see him and continued deeper into the large yard. He was just about to call out to her when he saw Xander trailing behind her. He stopped at the entrance and turned round, blocking the path.
Guarding it, Davood realized.
But why?
He was tempted to ask, but there was something strange going on here. The way Anila had acted in the coach the day before, as if she were ashamed of something. Sukru was encouraging her to do something. He just wasn't sure what. Using the sharpened point on his ring, Davood pierced his left wrist. He let the blood pool for a moment, then drew a sigil upon his palm, combining drift, descry, and obsess. Using that same hand, He scooped sand from the pathway and blew it into the cool morning air. It wafted towards Sander. Scintillant as it drove against the prevailing wind, it became so thin Davood could hardly detect it. As it passed the boneyard's entrance, Sander blinked. Then he shook his head and blinked again. The moment he turned away, Davood walked along the gravel path toward him. The crunch of his own footsteps made Davood cringe. Sander would surely have heard them, yet his gaze remained fixed on a tall minaret in the middle distance and remained there as Davood slipped past him and into the boneyard. The yard itself wasn't terribly large, but was so packed with grave markers, sepulchres and entrances to underground crypts, that one could easily get lost. Davood walked as silently as he could looking for Anila. When he caught movement ahead, he pulled up short and hid behind a large gravestone. Along the wall of the massive wing of the palace that held Sukru's residence were several dozen stone sepulchres, all with open entryways. Anila stood within one of these, her dark headscarf, skin, and dress making her look like a shadow within that enclosed space. She stood before a white sarcophagus, staring intently at the marble lid, which looked bright and new. Bella's grave. Anila had cared for the girl, but this visit felt like something more than paying respects to the dead. He was proven right moments later when Anila reached out and touched one finger to the sarcophagus lid. She moved her finger in a rough circle, then drew a line through it, followed by more embellishments, until it was clear she was drawing a sigil.
What good will it do, though?
He could see no blood. He thought back to the finch in the birdcage, how he had thought it dead, but it had awoken while he had been talking with Anila. He had known she was doing something arcane, but he hadn't pressed her. He should have, he realized now. A thin mist lifted from the sigil and spread like a fog. It drifted down from the lid in thin rivulets before the dry desert air swallowed it. Both of Anila's palms were held motionless above the sigil, as if she were warming them over a fire. When she tilted her head, Davood felt something deep inside him shift, akin to what he felt while summoning magic. A chill ran through him as more fog crept out from the crack beneath the lid.
Gods, it's coming from inside the sarcophagus.
It drifted down and spread along the floor, swallowing Anila's feet and ankles. And then Davood saw something he had hoped never to see again. The fog. It was rolling down Anila's form as well. Just as it had when she lay on the ground in Ishmantep after Davood's clumsy use of magic had burned her. Except this time she didn't appear to be in pain. Her skin wasn't broken and bleeding as it had been then. Davood could take it no longer.
Stop! He cried as he strode forward. Stop it!
Anila turned, her eyes wide with surprise.
Davood!
He grabbed her hands to pull her away from the sarcophagus and snatched them back a moment later. Her skin was so cold it burned.
Leave me!
She hissed.
This isn't right!
He just motioned to the sarcophagus when a thud came from beneath the lid. Anila froze, and Davood prayed it had merely been a shifting of the lid caused by the cold. But it came again a moment later. A thud that struck the underside of the lid. The next one came so hard it made him shiver.
Breath of the desert. The girl.
As Anila turned to the sarcophagus, a boom came from beneath the lid. So hard, the slab shifted. Anila began to whisper as a scratching, scrabbling sound came from within. She touched the surface of the marble, drawing another sigil. Crystals of ice trailed behind her finger, melting and evaporating as Anila complicated the sigil. A moaning came from within, growing more desperate by the moment, followed by screaming, pounding and scratching. Faster and more frenzied, as if the girl inside was fighting for her life. Visions of her came, a precocious thing running about the palace, her long hair loose and trailing behind her. Now she was trapped inside a sarcophagus, something other than what she had been. Anila continued to whisper, continued to draw lines of frost. Like a quieting sea, the sounds from within quelled. After long moments, all was silence once more.
"Why?" Davud asked. "Why would you do this to Bella?"
Anila turned to him, her eyes downcast.
"I had to know if I had enough power."
Davud thought of the firefinch.
"But to do it to a child? If she could help find Hamzakir, yes."
Across the boneyard, Xander, his long sword drawn, was running toward them. In that moment, a terrible thought occurred to Davud.
"Did you have a hand in killing Bella?"
The shock in her eyes made it clear that he had crossed a line, but even if Anila hadn't killed her, she was no longer innocent. The longer he thought on it, the more things fell into place. Xander guarding the entrance to the boneyard, Anila being given access to Bella's tomb.
"Sukru asked you to do it."
Anila turned angry.
"Of course he did. And stop looking at me like that. You know how he craves magic. That's why you're here. And that's why he let me remain when he found out about..."
She stared down at her hands.
"This..."
When Davud had spoken to the mage, using the triangle, he'd been told much the same thing about Sukru's hunger for power. But to sacrifice a child...
"What does he want you to do?"
"Say nothing more to him," Xander said as he reached the crypt.
His face screwed up in annoyance. He reached forward and took Davud by the arm. Davud raised the palm of his hand and drew a sigil for obfuscate and bind and fauna. And then a thing most strange happened. One moment he felt the spell consuming Xander. It wrapped around him like gossamer. But then it was shunted into marble beneath their feet, lost like so much water on parched earth.
"Sukru would likely never forgive me if I take his latest sorcerer from him."
Xander brandished his sword while gripping Davud's arm to the point of pain.
"But I won't shed a tear if you force me to spill your blood over all this pretty marble. We're leaving now,"
Xander said. When Anila said nothing, Davud allowed himself to be taken away. As Xander led him forcibly along the boneyard's well-tended paths, he looked back only once to find Anila standing in the sepulchre, watching the sarcophagus with an expression he could only interpret as satisfaction or hunger.
"Or both," Davud thought.
In his room, Davud rushed to the bureau and retrieved the golden triangle. He went swiftly to the patio, where the stars were fading with the coming dawn.
"Don't fail me," he said to the glittering field.
"I have need of you."
Sitting at the small table, he gave the triangle a spin. It fluttered like a dying moth, then fell to the mosaic tabletop with a jingle.
"Please,"
Davud whispered, and gave it another spin. This time it twisted in the air, bobbled and remained spinning above the table's colourful surface. It lifted reluctantly until it was eye level. For long moments he heard nothing but its whirring.
"Hello,"
Davud said.
"I'll admit,"
came the sparrow's voice.
"I never thought to hear from you again. I'm pleased.
Have you had the wisdom to heed my warnings?
In a manner of speaking, yes. You said I could come to you, that you would protect me.
And I meant it.
Could you protect Anila as well?
Your friend from the Collegia?
Yes, she has power like me, and Sukru is using her.
For what purpose?
I don't know. I was hoping you might be able to tell me.
I do not meddle directly in Sukru's affairs if I can avoid it. He has little talent in the Red Ways. But he has devices and artifacts. He hoards like a desert worm that I would have no wish to run afoul of. But,
she said before Davood could reply,
I've learned that she has power, and that it is distinctly different from yours.
Davood stared at the spinning triangle, haunted by the sound of Bella fighting to escape her tomb. If Anila were willing to do that to a child, what else might she do?
She is not gifted in the Red Ways as we are. Her arts are dark as the night.
He told the sparrow about the missing page from Sukru's book, the one that dealt with death, then described what had happened with the finch, finishing with Bella's story.
Your Anila is a disciple of Baki,
the sparrow said.
A necromancer. There have been rumors that the high priest of Baki's temple is one himself, albeit weak, but there has not been another for generations. It is said that those who stepped into the gateway to the Father Fields and returned to our world gain such powers, and that the more time they spend in that state so near to death, the more powerful they become. How long was Anila so?
A vision came of Anila, lying on the sand in Ishmantep, a cold fog rolling off her in waves.
A long while.
It's dangerous,
the sparrow went on.
The more they draw upon the ties that bind this world to the next, the closer they come to the Father Fields. Most die within a year.
Within a year? She could stop, though, and she would live.
Perhaps, but you must know that they are drawn toward death like moths to flame. The call of the Father Fields is strong. No doubt this is true for Anila as well. No doubt there is some great desire keeping her from giving into it as well. There always is.
Davood thought on it.
She wants Hamzakir's head.
If even half the stories I've heard of what he did to the Collegia's scholars are true, I've no doubt you're right. It might drive anyone to do what she's doing now.
Is that what Sukru wants, then? Hamzakir's death?
Who can say? Sukru may align himself with Keral, but he has other purposes.
Such as?
As I said, I steer well wide of Sukru and his interests. Now we have little time left.
Indeed, the triangle was slowing, a top ready to topple.
Will you shelter her?
Davood asked again. He heard the sounds of the palace's drawbridge being lowered, the rattle of chain followed by a boom. The triangle faltered. He thought it would fail altogether, cutting off the sparrow's answer, but then...
It's more dangerous, but yes, I could manage it. I would enjoy speaking with her.
How?
Davood rushed, relief tingling along his limbs.
How can I do it?
Summon the sigil for passage and doorway and cast it on the triangle.
Only when the stars are bright.
But it was too late. The triangle spun and clattered against the table, in dawn's light a perfect, bright triangle against the oddly shaped tesserae beneath. Chapter 33. Ignoring the persistent pain in his ankles and knees, King Onur tread over the rocky ground.
Dust demons swirled over the flat, slowly rising landscape. The sun was lowering, casting dark shadows beneath the scrub brush as he headed steadily closer to the rusty face of a grand escarpment. It ran like a ribbon into the distance and separated the near portion of the desert from a plateau above, a place choked with yew trees. Little grew along the ground below. Bushes fought for life beneath the harsh desert sun. Ironweed and desert thistle grew in the gullies. The differences were so stark it looked as though the elder gods had granted fertile soil above, while ceding the land below to the hunger of the desert. A crack ran down the escarpment's stone face. High above it was thin and difficult to see, but the lower it went, the wider the gap became, creating a natural cavern at ground level. Onur couldn't yet discern the size of it. The scale of this place made it difficult considering how far away he was. But as his heavy footsteps bore him closer, he realized how massive it was. A bloody cathedral could fit inside of it, and who knew how far back it went? Its depths were lost to darkness. He stared into the shadows as he came closer, clutching a large fire opal in his left hand. It was the most important of the prizes he had won in his battle against Tribe Masal, a legendary artifact of Tribe Salmuk, his familial tribe. He had heard stories of it from his grandfather when he was young, who'd asked about it the one and only time he had been taken by his father to visit his tribe in the desert. Most had refused to speak of it, but a waif of a girl had admitted to seeing it with her own eyes.
"Then why won't they admit it?"
Onur, 10 summers or so at the time, had asked her.
"Because you're from the city."
That one admission had done more to wake him to the realities of tribal life versus life in the city than anything in the hundreds of years since. He'd hoped to find the gem hidden away when he had come from Sharakai to take up his role as Sheikh. That he hadn't found it was no great surprise. He was only pleased that they were relatively certain who'd stolen it away. Tribe Masal, which was precisely why he had chosen them as the first of his conquests. When he judged he had come close enough to the gap in the stone, he stopped and held the opal before him. It had been a long while since he had been afraid, truly afraid. It felt good, made him feel alive. Fear would make his triumph here, and all that followed, feel that much more satisfying. The sun's rays threw orange and red and ochre against the stone's surface. It was a pretty thing, even he would admit that. But it was so much more than a simple jewel. It was one of the greatest treasures ever offered up by the Great Mother.
"I call upon you, Yerinde, goddess of love, crucible of desire. Heed my words, for your servant has need."
It grated to name himself a servant, but he recognized it for what it was. A sign of how long he had been a king of Sharakai. Given any man all he might wish for centuries, and he would see the world the same way as Onur did, as though everything he laid his eyes on was his to command. It was an attitude that served him well when he'd reached the camp of Tribe Salmuk, and again when he'd spoken to the survivors of his battle with Tribe Masal. Project an air of inevitability, of invincibility, and soon enough, everyone falls into line. He was no fool, though. With the gods he must take care. They were invincible, where he only pretended to be.
"I call upon you, Yerinde."
He held the stone higher.
"Too long has it been since we spoke."
The desert wind soughed through the dried bushes. Sand picked up, swirling in graceful curves before distending and fading altogether.
I call upon you,
he said a third time and threw the stone far ahead. It landed in a patch of sand and lay there, unmoving, the desert around it uncaring. But then the wind picked up. The sand around the stone lifted. For the span of a breath it twisted in the air, a living thing. And then it fell, the sand billowing outward. In the center of the cloud now stood a woman. She was naked, but as Honor watched, black insects, the size of children's teeth, scuttered up from the sand. They lifted into the air, creating a new sort of cloud, this one dark, iridescent, growing ever tighter around her frame. The insects landed on her skin, covering her arms, her legs, her chest and stomach. It looked as though she were wearing a dress that moved like a plague of termites. Her loose black hair became wind-tossed, obscuring her face for a moment, but as the wind died, it fell in long waves down her back. She stared with violet eyes at the stone which was now pinched between her thumb and forefinger. It looked small in her hands, which in turn made Honor feel small. He didn't like the feeling. She turned the opal this way and that, the sunlight continuing to play across its surface.
Many years has it been since I've seen the Eye of Dragons.
I found it that I might use it to further your glory.
Yorinde lifted her gaze to stare at Honor.
My glory, not thine own.
I have no wish for glory.
The goddess stepped closer. The winged insects, lifting, littering the air around her, then settling once more.
What is it, then, that fills your heart?
The journey toward justice.
Justice?
Yorinde's smile was like mulled wine, like golden honey freshly poured.
And when has the King of Spears sought for justice, save for himself?
Others will be served if I succeed. What matter that I might be served as well?
Her head swiveled until she was staring at the flame-filled jewel between her fingers.
And this will give it to you?
It will be a start.
She turned to him, stepped nearer. Honor could smell something on the wind, something floral and ancient, redolent of the elder gods, or perhaps the farther fields.
What would be thy wish, were I to grant thee the whole of the desert?
A quip was there on his lips, but the words died on his tongue.
Those eyes. They were deep and knowing, and yet aroused him to the point that he could hardly think.
In 400 years they hadn't changed in the least, and now they demanded truth from him. He found it, buried deep inside him, a thing he had hardly admitted to himself since well before leaving Sharakai for the desert.
I would wipe away all that you've done,
he said at last.
You and the other gods.
Her violet eyes twinkled.
And then?
And then I would give myself back to the desert.
Yorinde reared her head back and laughed. It was a sound that filled the desert, that played off the face of the cliff in the distance. Returning to him changed, mingling with the fresh petals that shook her frame. When at last her laughter faded, Yorinde blinked and a tear fell from her eye. Golden and glinting it fell on the fire opal. With it came a sense of something ancient awakening. A thing that had been hidden from the world but now returned. A titan the elder gods had thought dead before they'd departed these shores.
"Very well," Yurinde said, then held the opal out for him to take.
For a moment he couldn't move. He almost laughed. He'd lived for more than 4 centuries, well longer than any man had a right to live. He stood before a god who was offering him all he sought, and yet he wondered, as he had those many years ago on Toriat, why? Why did the gods enjoy their games so much? What was it they sought in the end? He wanted to ask her a question of his own.
"What would be your wish were you granted the whole of the world?"
But as he stared at the jewel, he decided he didn't much care what her answer would be. He took it from her open hand, feeling a warmth that hadn't been there before. The wind kicked up, blowing dust and sand into his face. When he'd blinked it away, Yurinde was gone, the dust clear for leagues around. Holding the jewel tight, he continued toward the cavern. The same thing he had felt before was there, deep in the shadows.
"Come," he willed. "Come and let the light of the desert shine on you once more."
As he came within several hundred paces, he felt a rumbling in the earth beneath his feet. Dust coughed from the entrance. No, smoke. A dense cloud of smoke. Shadows shifted. And he saw within the deeper darkness 2 glinting slits. Eyes that opened wide, spying him, their centers a complex weave of colors that were very much like the oranges and yellows of the opal. Relishing the fear now coursing through his veins, as well as the sheer potential of what he was about to do, Anur continued toward it, the pain in his knees and ankles all but forgotten. Later, as Anur, the king of Sloth, left the cavern, a woman watched. She stood in the open wearing simple, rough-spun clothes that blended well with the hard landscape. She was distant enough that it would be difficult for the king of spears to discern her form. The few times his eyes scanned the desert in her direction, a gust of sand would lift, obscuring her further until he'd looked away. She held a weathered staff with a gnarled head. The staff's butt against the sand, she pressed the head to her ear and listened to the rhythms of the world. They'd been altered by the events that had just taken place, and now it was up to her to discern them. She felt a deeper power in the cavern Anur just exited. She felt the eyes of the desert gods on it as well, which prevented her from going there to learn more. She sensed satisfaction in Onur's heavy tread, smelled the faint scents of vetiver and sweet grass and burning amber, all telltale signs of Yurinde. The breathing of the beast Onur had awakened rumbled in her chest. She felt an echo of each breath. As Onur regained his skiff and began sailing away, the sour feeling in her gut intensified. It was her own indecision, she knew. That and the impossible choices that lay ahead. There was danger along any path she chose, so which was the right one? The skiff grew smaller and smaller as she watched Anur chart a course not only for himself, but for the Great Mother as well. She knew she must do the same. As the skiff was lost on the horizon, the woman's form turned to sand, a crumbling column the wind soon ravaged and flung across the land. Chapter 34. When Ramad returned to the Chimeri Embassy house, he expected Meriem would be there, poring over the sigils he had gathered over the past few days. He had spent the morning collecting the last of them by going along the city's outer wall and making charcoal rubbings from those foundation stones containing sigils. There were 47 in all, an attempt on the part of the kings to protect their city from the Arek and other strange children of Goshen. Meriem had wanted to study the full set in detail before moving on to the next part of their plan, to find Hamza Kir, but she wasn't there.
"Gone to speak with the King of Kings," Basilio informed him when he asked of her whereabouts. "Without me?" Ramad thought. "Why wasn't I informed?"
Basilio sniffed and tugged his silk caftan tighter against his ample frame.
"Well, I'm sure I don't know." "What did she say?"
The oh-so-smug expression on Basilio's face, recognition of Ramad's fallen position with Meriem, was enough to make Ramad step forward, grab his caftan, and send him crashing into the wall.
"What did she say?"
Basilio was completely flustered.
"Unhand me, sir!"
He knew he should. He knew he had crossed a line that would be nearly impossible to walk back from. But all the rage that had been building inside him over having to run about the city like a common servant came pouring out in one big rush. He pulled Basilio back and shoved him back harder than before.
"I asked you a question!"
It was in that rage-filled moment that Ramad realized what was really driving his anger.
"Guldra, then. The Arek has been calling to me ever since I gave it my blood. Since I offered Chaders in payment for Hamza Kir's. And now it grows stronger."
Mighty Alu, if Meriem didn't do something soon, the Arek would have him. No matter that the sigils, the very ones he had been collecting for Meriem these past many days, protected him while he was within the city walls. He released Basilio. Basilio shoved Ramad away, then tugged his caftan down, trying to smooth out the wrinkles. His face was beet red as he lifted a finger to Ramad.
"If you ever touch me again in such a way, don't say anything you'll regret."
Ramad and Basilio both turned to find Meriem standing in the doorway.
"My queen,"
they said together, both bowing their heads.
"Yes, yes."
She stepped into the room, with a slight limp, but with an energy in her eyes that made it clear she was pleased, despite what she had just witnessed. Amaryllis followed, her long curly hair pulled into a horsetail that jutted from the top of her head. As Meriem stopped and faced them, Amaryllis continued into the next room and closed the doors behind her.
"Ramad has given insult."
Meriem waved to the place on the wall where she had just found the two of them.
"This and others, I'm sure. Suffice it to say that given what's happened in the recent weeks, there is good reason for Ramad to be overly protective of me. It doesn't excuse it," she went on, interrupting Basilio, "but it will be forgiven this once." "He struck me," Basilio said. "Then strike him back and be done with it." "You cannot keep such a man around, my queen." "Your advice is noted. Now either you take your measure of his hide or don't, but either way, be done with it and leave."
Ramad stood there with words of apology on his lips, but he couldn't voice them, not with Basilio staring at him as if he was owed it. Basilio shook with anger, but didn't lift a hand.
"You will rue this day."
He walked past Ramad and closed the doors behind him. Ramad was ready to spill his words of apology to Meriem, but before he could, She spun on her heels and walked into the room where Amaryllis had gone, so he kept them to himself and followed. Amaryllis was already sitting beside a small table. Miriam took the chair next to her, then waved Ramad to take the third. On the table was a simple lead box, with no adornments save for the arcane symbols marked into the sides, lid, and bottom. Around it, strapped crosswise, were two leather belts, a measure to keep the lid securely on. Next to the box were several implements, long-nosed pliers, as jewelers might use, iron scissors, freshly sharpened, a brass censer that hung from a tripod, a lit candle beneath that filled the air with a scent like burning sage, several simple white rags, and a jar of rendered goat fat. The last Miriam had prepared herself, first slaying and skinning the goat when the moons were dark, then rendering the fat in a pot set over a fire of white myrrh.
"Are you sure we're ready?" Ramad asked.
"We'll never be sure."
Ramad paused, wondering at the suddenness of the ritual after all the care they'd taken with the sapphire that now sat within the confines of the lead box.
"What happened with Kiral?"
"Later, Ramad."
She turned the talon ring on her thumb and made a beckoning motion to Amaryllis. As Amaryllis offered her arm to Miriam, Ramad reached out and snatched her wrist.
"What happened with Kiral?"
Amaryllis tried to free herself, but Ramad refused to let go. Miriam's eyes flared, but she seemed as in control of herself as Ramad was volatile.
"You'll get no answers that way, Ramad. Now release her."
When Ramad didn't, his palm lit with pain. He tried to fight it, but it was too much. He released Amaryllis, but the pain continued, a burning that made his skin feel as though it were on fire.
"Amaryllis, leave us."
Rubbing her wrist, Amaryllis rose.
"Yes, my queen."
She left the room, but not before giving Ramad a murderous glare. When the doors had closed behind her, Miriam regarded Ramad with placid eyes. His hand still shook with pain. It was now spreading to his wrist, and Miriam gave no sign that she was ready to release him.
"It is my fault, really," she said. "I knew Guldrathen would place a compulsion on you sooner or later. I've been meaning to ask you about it for some time, but, well, we've had much to attend to."
Ramad swallowed hard. A sweat had broken out all over his body, and he'd started to feel chill everywhere except his burning arm.
"You've done well with the sigils. We'll look at them soon, all of them. And we'll find a way to draw Guldrathen to the city."
She motioned to the lead box.
"Soon we'll have power we've only dreamed about."
Though the pain was making it nearly impossible to think, Ramad suddenly understood what Miriam meant to do, and why her meeting with Kiral meant so much to her.
"You found Hamzakir,"
Ramad forced out through his gritted teeth.
"Kiral gave you his location."
As suddenly as the pain had come, it was gone. Left in its wake was a deep itching sensation. As Ramad began to viciously scratch his arm and chest and neck, Miriam nodded.
"The end is near, Ramad. With the power of the sapphire you've stolen, we'll break the city's seals. And then we'll draw Guldrathen near and deliver what we've promised. He'll have Hamzakir, and we'll have gained Kiral's undying loyalty."
"Where is he?"
"It isn't where Hamzakir is now. It's where he will be. Kiral will meet him to discuss how the two of them would share power in the desert."
The itching had faded to a prickling sensation.
Why didn't you tell me?
Miriam's skeletal face softened ever so slightly.
I value you, Ramad, but for the good of the kingdom, I cannot allow myself to need you, you understand?
It had been difficult to let go of who they'd once been. Too often he still thought of himself as Chimera's ambassador, and Miriam, his aide.
Forgive me, he said. I wish to see us free from Goldrathen's shadow.
He motioned to the lead box on the table.
I'll help, if you'll still have me.
Miriam looked him over, eyes narrowing. Was there regret in her eyes? Ramad couldn't tell.
Very well,
she said, and they called Amaryllis back in. She strode across the room, all but ignoring Ramad, but when she sat once more, her look dared him to seize her arm again.
Don't think too harshly of him,
Miriam said.
Had you the compulsion of an Erek upon you, I don't know that you would fare as well.
She sent an off-handed wave toward the lead box.
And now we have another to contend with.
Amaryllis's shoulders softened and her hands unclenched, but she said nothing to Ramad.
You said it would be best to do it near High Sun.
So I did, Miriam replied.
Go ahead, Ramad.
Ramad nodded and undid the leather belts holding the lid closed and laid them down over the table. Miriam stiffened. Amaryllis swallowed and licked her lips. Ramad felt as if he were standing on the edge of a precipice.
Go on, Miriam said. Remove the lid. It will be weak for some time yet.
Ramad did, revealing the sapphire he'd stolen from Brahma. It lay on a bed of black velvet and was wrapped, web-like, in old dirty leather cord. It was one of the largest gems Ramad had ever seen. Even in the halls of Santrion, the royal palace of Chimera. It was easily the size of a falcon's egg. The facets were hopelessly occluded with grime, all but the front face, which was not clear exactly, nor as bad as the others.
It acts as a doorway, Miriam had told him,
when they had placed the gem into the box the first time.
A way for the Erek to see the world.
And then Ramad felt his gut twist just to look at it. Judging from the wary expression on Amaryllis's face, she felt the same. Miriam, however, stared not with the hunger she'd displayed days ago, nor with any sort of fear. She was intent, a blade poised to strike. It was the same sort of look she had had in Via Rosa, as she had tried day after day to break Hamzakia's will, except now she seemed even more grim. It bordered on dispassion, which only went to show how determined she was to succeed. Her battles with Hamzakia had tempered her, hardening a woman already harder than steel. Miriam held out her hand to Amaryllis, who promptly offered her wrist to her queen. Miriam pierced Amaryllis's skin with her thumb ring and quickly sucked the blood that came from the wound. After several long moments, Miriam released her, and Amaryllis coiled a waiting bandage around her wrist. Miriam had taken care to eat well these past few days, so that she would be ready. She was not weakened, as when she plied the red ways too often. Still, the change in her was remarkable. Her skin flushed, her breathing lengthened, her nostrils flared and her eyes became so dilated she looked inhuman. More than physical traits, however, was the sheer potency Ramad could sense within her. Most, even the powerful, were but gusts of wind in their fleeting lives. Miriam was a gathering storm, ready to strike. And she would need to be. What they were about to do was infinitely more dangerous than toying with Hamza Kir in the dungeon of Via Rosa. Ramad shuddered to think what the Arek might do if it managed to break free. Death or the Be a Mercy. After steadying herself, Meriem used her ring to pierce her own wrist, and Amaryllis picked up the long-nosed pliers. As Meriem held the dripping wound over the brass censer, she stared soberly at them both.
Quickly now. And whatever you do, do not touch the stone.
Ramad and Amaryllis shared a look. They both nodded as Meriem's blood sizzled on the censer's hot surface. When Ramad opened the lid, Amaryllis reached in with the pliers, pinched the jaws around the sapphire, and lifted it with the care of a jeweler preparing to tip molten silver into a mold. Ramad laid two of the clean rags on his open palm, and Amaryllis set the sapphire there. Ramad then grabbed the scissors and immediately set to work, snipping the leather cords around the sapphire one by one. They were stiff with age and smelled foul. Soon the gemstone was free, and Ramad rubbed the soot and grime from its faceted surfaces. It began to shine dully as he worked. Then it gleamed like no other stone he'd seen. It was perfect. A stone Alu himself might have shed in his tears during the making of the world. Beyond its physical appearance was a presence he had felt twice before. Once when he and Meriem had used Brahma, secreting themselves within his mind to find the caches of the king's life-giving elixirs, and again with Brahma in the cellar. It made Ramad's stomach turn to feel its malevolence toward him, toward Meriem, but the Arek was weak. Something in the nature of lead was anathema to them. So there was no difficulty as he used another rag to rub the yellow goat salve over the sapphire, nor as he suspended it over the censer. Trails of Meriem's burning blood curled upward, slowly coating the facets, occluding them, trapping the Arek within. Many had been killed when they had attempted to steal this gem from Brahma, making this ritual necessary. Meriem needed to make it subservient to her, not Brahma or anyone else. When all the facets were clouded, Meriem took a thick steel chain from around her neck. It had an oval-shaped locket, a device made to Meriem's exacting specifications, with two inner filigreed doors that allowed one to see the sapphire, and two more solid doors that would be closed to conceal it. The exterior was a bright, polished silver. The interior, however, was a dull grey. Lead. Ramad knew. The Arek were devious. Every precaution was needed to keep Rumayesh confined. Ramad held the pliers over the open locket and set the sapphire carefully within it. With a strange sort of tenderness, Meriem used a fresh rag to wipe away the gem's large, central facet. Then she clipped the inner doors closed, trapping the sapphire within, and replaced the small pin that would keep them secure. The sapphire gleamed within the locket. A blue so deep it reminded him of the austral sea, sailing and staring down into water so welcoming he yearned to dive in. He blinked, trying to clear the vision from his eyes, but he couldn't. He leapt from the edge of the ship and dove into the sea. The chill of the water embraced him, dragged him down, down, until he went rigid from it. He stared up at the sunlight spearing through the water. He stared below into the yawning darkness.
Come, it beckoned. Your daughter awaits, as does your wife.
He blinked once more and found himself staring into a different sort of darkness. He was on a blasted plane, standing on dark, glass-like rock. He'd returned to the desert,